Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. 2 years ago, a 7-year-old boy named Josh Hardy was in critical condition. He'd survived a bone marrow transplant, but caught the adenovirus, a bug that might give a healthy kid just a cold or maybe a case of pink eye. There was no treatment on the market, and Josh's doctors warned he might die within weeks. But as it happened, there was an experimental drug that potentially offered him a chance at life. Within hours of learning about it, Josh's mother took to social media, hoping to pressure the drug company that developed it, sparking a campaign that quickly went viral. It sounds like a story that might have a happy ending. But as my guest will explain, Josh's story and that of other patients like him have some scientists and medical ethicists deeply worried. Helen Ouyang is a physician and assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University. Her essay, Hashtag Prescription, The Hidden Cost of Crowdsourcing a Cure, is the cover story in the June issue of Harper's Magazine. Helen, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
Why did Josh Hardy get so sick from a bug that is typically pretty benign?
So Josh had been struggling with a very rare kidney cancer since he was about 1 year old. So he's gone through many rounds of chemotherapy, surgery, radiation, and recently had a bone marrow transplant, which had basically suppressed his immune system. So when he caught the adenovirus, he couldn't fight it off like normal kids can.
So what made his doctor think that this drug, and correct my pronunciation, please, brincidofovir, would be useful for him?
Well, there was already a drug out there, cidofovir, which has been proven to be effective, and it was given in an intravenous formulation, which means it had to be processed by the kidneys. Josh's kidneys were already shot. He was dependent on dialysis, which is a machine that helps the kidneys function, basically works in place of the kidneys. So he couldn't get that drug to treat the adenovirus. So there was a oral formulation of the drug that was being developed called brincidofovir, and his doctors, some of who were involved in the trials, thought it could be effective for him for that reason.
And how much testing had been done on the drug before Josh's case made it seem like it might be one of his only hopes?
Well, they first started testing the drug in 2006. They ran a phase 1 trial, which was just in healthy patients. But they were really testing it on another pathogen that has similarities to the adenovirus. So they had done some testing on that, and it seemed to be effective. And the adenovirus, they had finished phase 2 testing. So there's 3 phases to testing drugs. So they were about to start on the phase 3 test, but they hadn't done it yet. So it looked like it would be effective for him, but it definitely had not been proven to be safe or effective.
So as people know, drugs are tested for effectiveness, and they're tested for safety to make sure that, you know, side effects are well known and understandable. Under what circumstances do patients or their doctors request what is called compassionate use for a medication that is still in development?
So oftentimes these are drugs that are in clinical trials, and for whatever reason, the patient does not qualify for it. So it could be an age situation. We have heard of many cases where the patient was 15, so just below the age where they were willing to try an adult drug on them. Or for any other reasons, they didn't qualify for the drug trial, or perhaps they lived too far away and it wasn't convenient. Usually these drug trials are run at very large academic centers. So people who live in smaller towns or further away might not be able to uproot themselves to participate in the clinical trials.
And both the FDA and the company have to approve if they do decide to grant compassionate use?
Well, it's really much more in the hands of the companies. The way it works now, the companies have to agree to give the patient the drug, and then it goes to the FDA. So currently, the FDA has approved 99.4% of compassionate use requests. So the companies approve first, and then those requests go over to the FDA.
Okay, so the FDA approves 99.4%, I think you said. What percentage are approved by the companies that are in control of these drugs?
Well, we presume it's a lot less than that, but there's no data out there. So that's been one of the issues that people have been talking about, whether it should be much more transparent. So Senator McCaul, Texas, is involved in the 21st Century Cures Act, which is they want to make it much more transparent on every company's website, no matter how big or small, about their compassionate use data and how a patient or a doctor would go about requesting compassionate use for a drug.
Okay, Helen, how did the family's small-scale pitch on social media, like hoping that somebody might know a congressman who could do something, they were basically just talking to family and friends. How did this turn into a nationwide campaign so quickly?
So this was really fascinating, Chris. So I went and spent a weekend with the Hardys, and I was expecting them to tell me how they mounted this aggressive campaign, and I met with Amy Hardy and her husband, Todd, and they barely know how to use social media. I mean, Amy found out that they were being rejected for getting the drug. Their doctors had asked twice, and even the vice president and the president of the hospital had gone to bat for Josh, and the company said no twice. So she was just sort of updating her family, and instead of sending out a group email like a lot of us do, she just sent out a Facebook post because that was easier. She thought maybe somebody would know a congressman and that would be helpful, but really she was sort of updating her family. But then that got picked up by her brother-in-law, Bill Burns, and he went to work on Twitter. And if you read the article, you can see his first tweet that he put out. I mean, he really didn't know how to use social media either. I think he had about 10 followers when he first tweeted out.
At a distance, you know, if that's all the information I had, that there's a 7-year-old boy close to death and there's a drug that might help him and the company that's making it says no, it seems like, you know, a no-brainer to get the company to give him that drug. Certainly anybody on the planet could understand why Josh's family wanted it for him. What would cause Chimerix, the company developing this drug, or a company like that, to resist releasing it in a case like this?
So Chimerix was very unique in that it was a very small company. There was only 54 employees, and they only had the single drug, the sprinidafovir. It was the only drug that they were testing. So they were, first of all, reliant on a lot of federal funding. So the pathogen, adenovirus, has a lot of similarities with smallpox, which is feared that it could be used in bioterrorism. So after 9/11, the company got a $37 million grant from the National Institute of Health to investigate the drug. And then in 2011, that grant was renewed. So they had a lot of money, and because nobody actually has smallpox, it's been eradicated, they thought they could study it in these other viruses. So they were really reliant on this funding, and then when the funding ran out for any more clinical studies, they had to stop giving away the drug via compassionate use.
Mm-hmm. And how did Chimerix finally decide to release the medication to Josh? Tell us a little bit about how big this social media campaign got.
So this social media campaign really blew up, and it really, the regular media wrote on its coattails. So Amy Hardy was on Fox and Friends. She was on a bunch of local news stations. Her mother was on local news stations, and she was on CNN, and she was actually scheduled to be on World News with Diane Sawyer, but they got the drug before then. So it really blew up, and at one point, Kenneth Mock, who was the CEO of the company, and his wife had to go to a hotel because there was really major threats against them.
Hmm. How did Josh's body respond to the treatment?
So he did really well. In about 2 weeks' time, he had cleared the virus from his body. He was in the intensive care unit, and he was able to leave shortly after that. I spoke to his doctor at St. Jude Hospital, and he told me that he's absolutely positive that this drug saved his life.
What if he'd failed to get better or even died after he was allowed to have brincidofovir?
So that was a huge concern. Because the campaign had become so public and so many people were involved and now knew about the drug, if he had died from taking the drug, even if simply because he was very sick, you know, he had gone through so many rounds of chemotherapy and radiation, a lot of people would have blamed the drug. And not only would this be a problem in terms of enrolling clinical trials, who wants to join a trial if they just found out somebody had died from it? Also, Chimerix, because it was so small, the 54 employees, they were really reliant on a lot of outside funding, and the whole company could have collapsed.
Let's listen here to former Chimerix CEO Kenneth Mock explaining to NPR's On the Media his initial reluctance to release the medication.
The tenor from the beginning was, how could you not make this drug available? there was never a sense in the media coverage of the dilemma or ethical debate that exists. Josh Hardy had a very positive response to Brin Sadoffavir, and everybody looked at this and said, it's magnificent. The child got the drug. He survived. But what might have happened to the development program if Josh Hardy had an equally rapid and negative response? Is it possible that that might have slowed down the development pathway for Brin Sadoffavir by a week or a month or 2 months or a year? And if that had happened, would not the patients who might have received the drug in the future during that month or 2 months or year themselves possibly have died?
So what he's saying here, if I understand correctly, Helen, is that if Josh had responded badly, it could have actually meant that people who would ultimately have benefited from a drug like this would never get it, or there would be just a big delay.
That's correct. So anytime there's a bad outcome, such as death, the FDA is mandated to look at that and see what happens. So actually, at the end of 2014, another company had a drug called aldoxorubicin, and there was a patient who was very, very sick and didn't qualify for the clinical trials. He got the drug through compassionate use, and he died shortly after, and they had to pause the drug trial for 2 months. So the people who were in the trial continued on, but they weren't enrolling any new patients. So you can imagine the delay in getting the drug out.
And it could be that he died because this drug killed him. It could be that he died because he got it too late. It's hard to say exactly what the relationship is between the drug and the outcome for the patient.
That's right. A lot of these patients who don't qualify for clinical trials are already very, very sick and end of life, and is one of the reasons they may not qualify for the trial.
Kenneth Mok insists that the initial reluctance to release Brin Sadoffavir had nothing to do with money. Is that a credible answer?
Well, I think in terms of the dollar amounts of how much it would cost to just make several doses of the drug, which is what Josh needed, the company probably could have afforded that. And also, there was such a public outpouring that they were able to gather enough money that they could have bought the drug from the company. In the greater sense, I think, you know, economics does play in, because these drug companies, they're private ventures. They depend on venture funding. They depend on investors, and they need to keep the company going in that way. So if there was this bad outcome and the companies look bad, they could lose a lot of funding. And in that sense, finances do play an important role.
And the finances matter. I mean, profit motives are there, but the finances also matter, because without investor money, any kind of testing for any drug is not possible.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Especially for a small company like this. A larger company might be a little bit different. They have a lot more buffers.
Kenneth Mok is no longer CEO of Chimerix. Why was he let go?
So I've spoke to a company spokesperson at Chimerix, and he didn't deny that his firing was related to this situation. I think this is the first time that the company had faced such, you know, a social media backlash at them, and the board became uncomfortable and he was let go.
We're speaking this hour with Helen Ouyang, a physician and assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University. Her essay, Hashtag Prescription, The Hidden Cost of Crowdsourcing a Cure, is the cover story in the June issue of Harper's Magazine. If you'd like to join our conversation about compassionate use of drugs, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email the show, that's at think@kera.org, or you can find us on Twitter at @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program, with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour to physician Helen Ouyang. She is an assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University and author of the essay Hashtag Prescription, The Hidden Cost of Crowdsourcing a Cure, that is the cover story in the June issue of Harper's Magazine. It's about compassionate use of experimental drugs for people who are very ill. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. Okay, Helen, so we've talked a little bit about the financial implications of this. There is also the question that if there are opportunities to receive a drug that appears to be beneficial through compassionate use, it gets harder and harder to sign people up for a study where they realize they might get the actual drug or they might get a placebo.
That's definitely true, especially now, since people post all the time on websites, people know that they might not be getting a drug because of they're not experiencing the side effects that the other people are experiencing. Have even been cases of people who've dropped out of trials and then tried to get the drug through compassionate use? Because if you go into a trial, you might get the standard therapy or you might get a placebo. And if you go through compassionate use and you're successful, then you're guaranteed the drug.
And there are some drugs that are in testing that are really hard to find a sufficient population of people to even test them for safety and effectiveness. Is that right?
Yes, that's true. Mm-hmm.
How does recruitment work with a new experimental drug? How do pharmaceutical companies and universities find willing and able patients?
Well, a lot of these patients find out through their doctors, but there's a lot of them who are very, very savvy, who go on websites such as smartpatient.com, and they hear about all these experimental drugs. They oftentimes know a drug is going to get approved before the company has even put out a press release. So I think it's really moved towards a patient-initiated avenue towards getting into some of these trials. But, of course, the doctors are still very involved.
Mm-hmm. Is there any guarantee that patients who are in the control group of a study, if a drug is successful, will they be first in line to then actually receive the drug later on? Do they get any kind of special preference?
That's a good question. I have not heard of them getting any special preference. There are very limited cases where if a drug has proved so successful that it doesn't seem ethical to continue the study, in which case they would stop the study and the drug would become rapidly approved.
So it's almost the same as when a drug appears to be very dangerous and a trial is stopped. It occasionally works the other direction, that a drug works so well that it doesn't seem fair to deny people.
Right. But usually that doesn't happen as often in, cancer-related therapies, where even when a drug trial is successful, the efficacy is not that great.
How does testing work when it's been conducted on adults and the patients are children? Are there special hurdles to overcome in order to get that drug to kids?
So that's been a controversy in the pediatric cancer world, is that most of these drug trials are in adults. So there's been statistics that the National Cancer Institute spends less than 5% of their budget on pediatric cancers. And, logically, it's because there's a lot less pediatric cancers when you break them apart across specific cancers than adults. So that's one big reason. But there's also, doubters who think that it's because it's not as financially lucrative to have a cancer drug for pediatrics rather than adults. But once a drug is actually approved and on the market, then you can get the drug regardless. It's called off-label use.
From a distance, it's really easy to understand why it's important to create conditions that make it possible for drugs to be tested the way they're supposed to be tested. Everything changes when you have someone that you care deeply about who might die without trying this last-ditch effort.
Yes, definitely. All the doctors I spoke to were, talked about the importance of randomized controlled trials and going through the process and having patients on the drug and patients on the placebo. But every single doctor said, if it was my child, I would have acted just like Amy Hardy did in the article or Kathy Liu did and done everything they could to get the drug.
What happens when, I mean, do doctors think twice before informing patients that there might be hope from a compassionate use dispensation of a drug?
You know, that's a good question. So in the case of Josh Hardy, his doctor was very intimately involved with the drug trials, and they had tried other options for treating Josh, and all of them had failed. So he really was savvy and knew that this drug had a good chance of working, but he still believed in going through the scientific process. But that calls into the question of fairness, because with some patients, they might be in a smaller hospital, might not be an academic hospital, and their doctors might not know about the drugs. And if they don't have the resources and the know-how to go on the internet and to liaise on these patient websites, they might not hear about the drugs.
Do most companies have step-by-step protocols that they have to look at and follow before they allow compassionate use of a medication they're developing?
So all the companies are very different and vary, and I think that's part of the problem is how not transparent the process is. So a lot of times you go on a drug website and there might be a phone number to call, and you call and it's just an administrative person who answers, and it might be many days to weeks or if ever that you get a direct response from someone higher up at the company. And that's been, you know, a major issue with a lot of patients in terms of the compassionate use program.
How are the results of compassionate use applications of drugs factored into the conclusions drawn by, say, randomized control trials? Do they have to be sort of written in as a footnote, or what happens to those?
So they're really not factored in, and that's why a lot of scientists take issues with these compassionate use protocols, because you're not gathering good data from them. And a lot of times it might be administered to the patient from a doctor who doesn't participate in clinical trials, so they don't even know how to necessarily do all the forms and the data collection. So if there's a terrible outcome, that will be useful and it will inform the trial and it will be researched. But anything in between, it's really hard to use that data.
So with compassionate use, we certainly have evidence that there are patients who have been saved. There are patients who have perhaps been harmed by drugs that were not yet ready for market. How much evidence do we have specifically that the things we're afraid will happen, that investors will back down, that other patients won't want to be part of these studies? Do we have hard evidence that these things actually take place after the compassionate use release of a drug?
We have some evidence. And just to go back to your previous point, Josh Hardy did remarkably well, but as Kenneth Mock said, this was a very unusual situation. I spoke to many bioethicists and doctors, and really there's been no case like Josh Hardy where someone got a drug through compassionate use and did so well. Many people have done worse after getting the drug, or maybe to survive a couple weeks longer, but to have a turnaround like Josh Hardy was an exceptional case. But even if you can look at chimerics, and they gave, for instance, brincidofovir to Thomas Duncan, the Liberian man who was the first to be diagnosed with Ebola, and it wasn't intended to be an Ebola drug, and then when he got the drug and didn't do well, their stock dropped 10%. So you can see how just hearing that someone doesn't do well on a drug, even though the drug wasn't intended or manufactured for that purpose, it can really have a big effect on the company.
Do patients or their families, depending on how able the patient is to make decisions for himself or herself, do they sign away every right when they accept compassionate use medication?
Well, they definitely have to go through informed consent, and it's looked at by the institutional review board. So every hospital has a review board that goes through the process and makes sure that it's ethical and that, you know, the patient knows that they're consenting to this drug. So a lot of times people fear that when you're on the brink of death that you don't know what you're signing away and all the side effects of the drugs. And some people have taken the drug and have died quicker or have done a lot worse, so that their last days of life are a lot more miserable than if they hadn't taken the drug.
People often talk about, you know, certain medications being available overseas that we can't get in this country because they are still being tested or they have not been approved by the FDA. How do American trial protocols for new drugs compare with those of, say, the EU?
So there's always this thought that the FDA is taking forever and that there's all these miracle drugs sitting on the shelves. So there was a study done a couple of years ago where it compared the FDA to their European counterpart and showed that actually the FDA is twice as fast at approving drugs. The other issue is getting drugs from overseas. So Kathy Liu, the second family in the article, so she was trying to get an experimental drug for her son who also had kidney cancer, though a different form. She was going to go to Japan and try to get the drug. But Japan, unlike the U.S., doesn't even let you use the drug off-label. So here, if a drug is approved, once it's out on the market, if you find a doctor who is willing to give you the drug, you can get it, even if it's for a different indication or a different age group. But in other countries, they're more strict and they won't even let you do that.
And we should say that Kathy Liu's family had a very different outcome.
She had a very different outcome. So her son Joey was diagnosed with kidney cancer, and when he was diagnosed that day, they found out that it had already metastasized all through his body. So Kathy just really became a warrior and did incredible research and talked to basically every doctor out there, patients, their families, went to scientific conferences all across the country, read international medical journals to try to fight and get any type of drug for Joey. And, you know, she eventually got the drug, but she felt it was much too late. And after two doses of the drug, he succumbed.
Hmm. You know, it's understandable that anybody fighting for the life of a loved one would say, you know, at some point, you're not even in a position to make a good decision about risk because you will do anything.
Yes, that's definitely true. You know, I've definitely talked to a lot of doctors who are in palliative care, in the life care, and they talk about how some families, they spend so much effort and time trying to get their hands on an experimental drug that they sort of don't spend those last moments with their loved ones. Hmm. But on the flip side, some family members really need to do that to feel some sort of closure, like they've done everything they could. And if without doing that, you know, they have a lot of guilt. Like when I spoke to Kathy Liu, she still feels like, despite everything she did, that she still didn't try hard enough.
What do you say to people who, you know, hear stories like this and are inclined to push, you know, to pressure a company to provide compassionate use? I mean, what should we think, you know, when we just send along an email or make a phone call or just hit like on a button?
I think we really need to think twice about what that means. First of all, are these drugs even appropriate for the patients? Lots of times it's just a Hail Mary situation and it can make the patient worse or die faster. And second of all, we need to really reckon with our decision to support this because, you know, like the drug in 2014, which had to stop for 2 months because a patient died from it, those are real ramifications. That's a 2-month delay in possibly getting the drug to market, but also a 2-month delay in which the drug trials completely stop. So there are these patients that we don't think about because maybe they're not sick yet or they just don't have names like Josh Hardy or Joey, as in the second family. And it's hard to reckon with our choices when they're not right there in front of us. But these patients exist. You know, it could be you or your loved one in the future who needs a drug.
You explain in the article that compassionate use became more common in the 80s at the height of the AIDS epidemic when there really felt like there was very little we could do for these patients who were getting sick and dying. Can you take us back through that history and how that came about?
Sure. So back in the 80s, the antiretrovirals were starting to be researched and coming out, and the HIV community just felt like it was coming out much too slowly. So ACT UP was the big advocacy group that really pushed, that said, you know, people are dying, you know, this disease is outpacing the drug research, and that these patients are all terminally ill and they deserve access to the drug. So that really pushed the idea of compassionate use to the forefront.
Hmm. Why do you think the reporting of this issue has been so much, frankly, it sounds like it's been really simplistic?
Well, I think when you look at a child who's dying and there's a drug out there that has a chance of saving them, or it's nothing, it's really hard to say no, because it's just incredibly difficult to look at, you know, again, the patients who aren't there in front of you, who don't have names and pictures. So when you look at it in terms of each child and this potential access to a life-saving drug, it's so hard not to say, of course, give the child a drug. But we don't think about all the side effects, and we don't think about all the future patients that might not get access to the drug if something bad happens.
Yeah. And, of course, there's also the possibility that a drug is perfectly good. It just didn't work for that patient. But a bad outcome makes everyone stand back and think maybe it's not such a good idea to proceed.
Yes, that's definitely true. Such as the Thomas Duncan case, when mm-hmm. the stock just fell because people were scared.
What's the status of brincidofovir's development today?
So in terms of adenovirus, you know, the drug trials are moving forward, and it's done really well, and it hopefully will get approved for that. But the original intention, the cytomegalovirus, which is this, you know, related pathogen to adenovirus. So the phase 3 results came out at the end of last year, and it actually showed that it wasn't as favorable as they thought. So in the short term, a couple of weeks into the trial, when patients were on the drug, they did really well and seemed to not get cytomegalovirus as high of a rate as the placebos. But then when they came off the drugs a few weeks later, it seemed like it was much more even, the results. So it's questionable now what's going to happen.
We're speaking this hour with physician Helen Ouyang, assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University and author of the essay Hashtag Prescription, The Hidden Cost of Crowdsourcing a Cure. It's the cover story in the June issue of Harper's Magazine. If you'd like to be part of this discussion, you can find us on Twitter at KERAThink. You can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with physician Helen Ouyang. She's assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University and author of the essay Hashtag Prescription, The Hidden Cost of Crowdsourcing a Cure. You can read it in Harper's this month. It is the cover story, actually, for the June issue. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We have an email here from Jay who writes, the randomized controlled study is propped up as the gold standard, but that doesn't mean it is the most ethical research method. There are research methods that don't require a control group where all groups are given the drug and then compared. Also, the reigning paradigm of statistics the FDA uses is the null hypothesis significance testing, which is in opposition to Bayesian statistics. If this drug had been tested using Bayesian statistics, it may very well have been approved. What do you think of that, Helen?
So there's definitely been a move towards single-arm trials, which is actually how Josh Hardy got the drug. So a single-arm trial is there's no control group, so there's no one that's getting the placebo or the standardized therapy. Everyone's getting the drug, and they're studying it that way. So that is one way around randomized controlled trials. But the problem is it doesn't really help us fully answer the question whether a drug is effective. For instance, if patients are on different therapies or they are natural course of their disease, or they take their diet even, any of those things can factor in. And the randomized controlled trial is still the purest way of testing.
In randomized controlled trials, though, certainly there are still varying outcomes among people who do and do not receive the medication, right?
Right.
All right. Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Dane on the line in Colleyville. Hi, Dane.
Hey, good morning. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Good. A quick story for you. I was diagnosed with chronic myelogenous leukemia in late 1999 and started doing conventional chemo and blood transfusions, and none of it was working. And I was approaching blast phase, and I attempted twice to get into a clinical trial for a new drug. At the time, it was called SD571. Now it's called Gleevec, and it's the first line of treatment for leukemia of this type. In any case, the first time I wasn't sick enough to qualify for that trial. The second time I was too sick to qualify for the second trial. Eventually, I just went to the mountain, and I went to MD Anderson in Houston and made a lot of noise and fought to get into a trial, and I finally made my way into one, which eventually saved my life. And I took that drug and was in remission within a year and took it for 4 more years before I developed resistance to it. Ended up with a regular bone marrow transplant, but I had gotten strong enough from taking the drug for 4 years to withstand the transplant. The point I'm making, sometimes it's just not enough to apply. Sometimes you have to be your own advocate, and you have to fight your way into these trials if you think they're going to help you. And I'll take my response offline, but thank you.
Well, Dane, thanks for calling. I'm glad you're still with us. Any thoughts, Ellen?
I'm glad you're doing so well, Dane. I agree. You know, one of the cancer groups, Kids Versus Cancer, is trying to gather data from patients who don't qualify for the clinical trials so that at least they can sort of use these compassionate use requests and try to gather some data from it so it can inform the whole scientific process. There's definitely, it's important for patients to be their own advocates these days.
Well, I was going to say that there's the reality that some patients can't be their own advocates and they don't have anyone else to advocate for them. They might be children whose parents don't have the education or resources. They might be single adults without family or close friends able to take on that role. And there are ethical questions that surround that too, right?
Yes, definitely. Art Kaplan, who was the one person, he's a bioethicist at NYU, and he was the one person who really spoke out against the Hardee's campaign. And one of the issues that he raised is that, you know, they are still an educated, relatively well-off family that was able to sort of use some sort of social media and also were savvy enough and health literate enough to understand the drugs and the drug trials and that whole concept. And that already puts them a step up compared to a lot of families who don't have those resources.
How do doctors explain this? How do drug companies explain this when they have to say no to families who are, frankly, desperate?
That's one of the issues. A lot of times the drug companies don't get back to families, or when they do, there's no explanation why. So, you know, the Janssen, which is the pharmaceutical subsidiary of Johnson & Johnson, is trying to have a committee. They did a trial where it's a group of bioethicists, patients, physicians, a whole group of people who sort of examine these cases, and if they say no, they have to give a reason why.
Are insurance companies involved in these fights at all?
Usually, you know, I know we talked about the financial reasons for not giving a drug, but usually a lot of times the companies will just, if they're going to give a drug through compassionate use, they will actually just give the drug. Part of the reason is they don't want people to know the actual cost of the drug. You know, when the drug goes to market, the cost is baked in, includes all the randomized controlled trials and phase studies that went through for possibly a decade of developing this drug. So it's not just, you know, blanket at cost. So usually, you know, they'll just give the patient the drug. But the family still has to have the resources, for instance, to go to possibly a certain hospital and stay there for extended period of time. Like Josh has and his family have been in Memphis for months.
How's he doing now?
He's still struggling, but definitely better. He's in Memphis now. Recovering, but he has been back home to Virginia, which is where I saw him. But in terms of the adenovirus, you know, that's completely cleared his body.
You have done other writing for, I believe, the New York Times about your work with patients in the emergency room looking for pain medications and the many ethical questions and healthcare questions that this raises. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about your concerns about the way we do things now when a patient enters the emergency room looking for pain medication without maybe a history that the doctors in that emergency room are familiar with.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole opioid crisis has really reached its peak, and it's a conundrum how we're going to solve it. You know, a lot of these patients, the reason I wrote that New York Times piece is because a lot of these patients, they first became hooked on opioids from their doctors. You know, someone gets surgery and they get 50 oxycodones to go home with, and that is the beginning of their addiction. And I think our healthcare system really makes it hard to say no. It makes it hard to say no in terms of compassionate use. It makes it hard to say no in terms of someone asking for opioids drug prescription. You know, we have patient satisfaction scores that we have to deal with. A lot of times these patients, if they don't get the drugs, they can get very angry. A lot of these patients, if they don't get it from you, they'll just go somewhere else and they'll get it. Or they'll even come back in on a later time or day when there's a new doctor on and maybe they'll get it. So there's a lot of inconsistencies in how we're dealing with this.
So what do we do about that? Because, you know, there are other cases where people are legitimately in pain. I've been with a family member who has a health condition and when she has a problem is often treated like a drug seeker when I know that not to be the case.
Right, definitely. I mean, I think people ought to have pain clinics and pain doctors who can help manage their pain more effectively over a longer period of time, and their primary care physicians who know them well. I mean, it's always a judgment call when you think whether they're pain-seeking. I think the new system that the New York State has implemented, the iStop, which is you can look up a patient and see where they're getting their prescription from, that's pretty helpful because you can see whether they're shopping around, have already gotten all these drugs from another doctor just a few days earlier. So that's been helpful, too.
All right, let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Pushpa on the line in Dallas. Hi, Pushpa.
Hi, Ms. Boyd. Let me first tell you that I heard you at Hockaday day before yesterday at the graduation. You are a phenomenal speaker.
Thank you.
And I enjoy your voice on pink. I do have a question for Dr. Yang.
Okay.
And can I ask right now?
Absolutely. Go right ahead.
All right. Dr. Yang, you mentioned how a medication can be different from different one patient to the other depending on what diet they're on and depending on what where they are in their illness. And my question to you is, what about the emotion that is playing a role in any ailment? Do you think that is a factor that one should look into as one is being given a medication and why is something did not work? Oh, it worked. Is that something that you would take into consideration apart from just the diet?
That's an interesting question.
Hi, Pushpa. So I definitely think, you know, I think that's why we started to have these placebo-controlled trials so that we can try to factor in everything. I sort of look at the single arm trials if you're looking at a track race and if you have runners doing, for instance, a 100 meter dash. And in the single arm trial, everyone's running on a different day, so weather could be an issue. They might be wearing different shoes on a different track in different cities. In the randomized control trial, I look at it as everyone is running the 100 meter dash at one time on the same day in the same city. So hopefully the placebo-controlled trials will sort of factor in such issues as the emotional state of the patient. But it's definitely something that should be looked into more.
How common is it for the physicians who are just overseeing a randomized control trial to form suspicions about who's actually getting the drug and who's getting the placebo?
I don't know how often that is, but I think it's only natural that you would factor that in based on, you know, the side effects that people are getting.
Has there ever been an effort to, like, it sounds awful, but to put false side effects in a placebo? Because is the placebo anything more complicated than literally a sugar pill in most cases?
Yeah, I think that's really going to become an issue in the next 5 to 10 years because, again, because of these patient websites and social media, you know, they're all talking to each other so they know and start comparing side effects, and it really can start clouding some of the clinical trials. So that was one of the issues I was sort of talking to Kenneth Mock about, and I think it's going to really come up to the surface more in the next several years.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Richard on the line in Rockwall. Hi, Richard.
Hello.
Hi, Richard.
I'd like to, the point I would like to make, I practiced rheumatology in Dallas for many years. And at one time I had a patient with psoriatic arthritis, a common disease, who had failed what at the time was considered to be standard therapy. There were multiple journal articles in good journals such as the New England Medicine, et cetera, finding out how a new drug that was very expensive was often effective in cases like this. But when I tried to get to use it in him, his insurance company denied it because it wasn't FDA approved for that disease.
Well, we're getting a little feedback on your call there, Richard, but I think Helen has the gist of what you wanted to talk about. Do you want to respond to that?
Sure. So that's a good question, Richard. A lot of these drugs, when you use them off-label, it becomes an issue in terms of affording the medication. You know, in terms of compassionate use, I think many times the companies will just front the cost of the drug. But you're right. In off-label use, it becomes a problem whether insurances will pay, and most will not.
All right. So what should we do the next time we see one of these really hard-to-ignore social media posts? What do you recommend? What questions should we ask ourselves before we take action?
I mean, I think you should definitely look into, you know, the data about the drug and just think about some of these issues that are raised about whether it would affect future patients getting a drug. But I think, you know, it's human instinct to want to help each other and rescue each other. And I don't know if that's, at the end of the day, necessarily a bad thing. I think it's kind of a beautiful thing that this little boy was able to stir the hearts of all of these strangers who never even met him. And I don't know if we should necessarily shut that off. End of the day.
Do Josh Hardy's parents have any regrets?
No, and they always say, you know, they understand drug development. They never wanted to harm Chimerix or Ken Mock, but at the end of the day, they just wanted to save their little boy.
Helen Ouyang is a physician and assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University. Her essay, #prescription, the hidden cost of crowdsourcing a cure, is the cover story in the June issue of Harper's Magazine. Helen, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you very much for making this time for us.
Thank you so much, Chris, for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Samantha Guzman is associate producer with help on the phones today from Javier Giribet. And our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Our Twitter handle is @KERAThink. Mine is still @ChrisBoydThink. You can contact the show via email at think@KERA.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.